Well, 50 years ago this summer, an event that changed the world, not just the music world, but gave us some hope that perhaps people could gather and enjoy themselves in a peaceful way. We're talking, of course, about Woodstock as the 50th anniversary approaches. A guy who was there, who's been writing about music for decades now, looks back. He's talked to nearly two dozen people who were there as well. Mike Greenblatt is the author of a new book entitled Woodstock 50th Anniversary, Back to Yasgur's Farm. Mike, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my honor. Thank you for having me.
Well, you get off to a good start. We know the pedigree is pretty solid, not just because you were there, but when you get the foreword written by Country Joe McDonald, you know things are going to be pretty honest.
Well, you hit the nail on the head with what you just said in the intro about peace and that it showed some hope that many people can be together in one spot. And don't forget, there wasn't enough food, there wasn't enough water, there wasn't enough bathrooms, and it had horrible weather, yet there was not one reported instance of violence. And no police. It's almost impossible.
Well, one of the things that made it such a success, too, is that the promoters, the organizers, at some point in the weekend realized, all right, the fences have come down. We can't keep people out, and we're not going to try. We're just going to enjoy this, and we may lose our shirts, but that's not what this is all about.
Exactly. And the movie really nailed it. I really love the movie because I get chills when I hear John Morris make that announcement from the stage when he says that doesn't mean that you got to help each other, man. He goes, we got to look out for each other. The producers of this festival are going to take a bath, a big bath. They're going to lose their shirts, but your safety and enjoyment is more important than the almighty dollar. I still get chills when I hear that in the movie.
What was your story, Micah? What drew you there and what were your experiences?
We weren't even going to go. Led Zeppelin was playing down the shore in Jersey. We were going to go see Led Zeppelin. But the advertisements on the radio with all these bands, they were all our favorite bands. At one spot in one weekend, we knew we had to go. So we spent $17.50 a piece for a three-day pass. We got there on Thursday afternoon. We parked. We got to the stage. They were still building it the day before. And there was nobody to give our ticket to, so we just threw them away. And we left everything in the car. We figured we'd come back for it later. And that included food, water, clothing, tent, blankets, toothbrush, toothpaste. Truth is, we never made it back to the car. we didn't even know where the car was.
Well, that was a familiar story for a lot of people who, whenever they got on the highway, realized the traffic jam was backed up for miles and miles and miles, and you were going to have to get there on foot if you would make it at all.
Well, we did get to the parking lot. There was no way I was going to just abandon my car. I can't see doing that. But the traffic jam going there, even on Thursday, the day before the festival, was so bad. We took out the Monopoly set, and we played a game of Monopoly on the roof of the car before we even moved again.
So you've talked to, over 20 artists, performers who were there. For many of them, the event changed their musical lives as well. Who were some of the memorable folks you talked to for the book?
Well, members of Jefferson Airplane, Santana, Creedence Clearwater Revival, Canned Heat. I was lucky enough, because I've been a journalist for the last 35 years, to have gotten to Richie Havens. I was his publicist at one time, and I remember in 1984, at the 15th anniversary of Woodstock, I got us both on the radio in New York City, and from the perspective of the fan and the artist. And thank God, my mother taped it, and it was never rebroadcast. Those quotes from Richie have never been heard before, other than that one time on the radio in 84, but I found the tape. And I transcribed it, and that's what's in my book, what he said that morning. And that's where the quote on the back cover comes from. We're all still at Woodstock. And that's so true in so many ways.
Well, and Richie was such a key part of it, too. If I remember right, they had to move him on the schedule and adjust, and his flexibility in many ways enabled the festival to go right along and not skip a beat.
Correct. There were plenty of artists that were hanging out backstage and under the stage that were scared like hell to have to go on first. Don't forget, it was 8 hours late, the concert. And the people were scared to go on. And finally, Richie goes, man, I'll go on, but they better not throw stuff at me. And it turned out that his set, the very first piece of music we saw, and boy, were we starved for music at that point, was one of the more iconic sets where he made that song Freedom Up extemporaneously. And, you know, when he died, his ashes were sprinkled over the site at Woodstock.
Oh, wow. We're talking with Mike Greenblatt. His new book is called Woodstock 50th Anniversary, Back to Yasgur's Farm. You mentioned Creedence. We talked to Stu Cook a few weeks ago on the program, and he was telling us that he was disappointed, the rest of the band disappointed, that they didn't make it into the Woodstock movie. And apparently the big reason was John Fogerty just didn't like their performance and didn't think it was good enough and said no.
Well, John Fogerty was dead wrong. I was in the audience, and I thought Creedence sounded great. You know, back then, when you're 18, in 1969, you judged a live band by how closely they sounded to the album. And Creedence's music is like the DNA of rock and roll. You know, it's primal. And they sounded phenomenal. Doug Clifford and Stu Cook hate John Fogerty to this day, and they have some very colorful things to say about him in my book. So naturally, I tried to call John Fogerty's publicist, because he's still touring, and they basically told me, he's not talking about it, go buy his book. So I did. And the quotes in my book from Fogerty are from his book. There's a bibliography in my book. I read 9 books during the course of the production of my book. And like people like Bill Graham, who was such an important figure at Woodstock, giving Michael Lang his entire staff and vouching because he was a novice. But I did 32 interviews in all. And it's like a tapestry. I weave the tapestry from different perspectives. Mine, of course, the 32 interviews and the 9 books.
One of the people you interviewed, Graham Nash, we played Crosby, Stills, and Nash coming into the segment here, and those harmonies absolutely electrified people at Woodstock.
Yeah, yeah. And to think they weren't going to play because Stephen Stills got too scared and he had his manager, Elliot Roberts, call Michael Lang and go, you know what? We're backing out. And Michael Lang, I think it was John Morris again, actually, said, listen, we're playing your debut album over the loudspeakers and everybody's loving it. And that did the trick. So they played. And boy, were they good. I have various reports of how good they were, even though Stills was scared. Nash wasn't scared. Nash told me a wonderful story for this book about how when they got back to Manhattan in the suite that he had with his girlfriend, Joni Mitchell, who was so upset that she didn't get to play Woodstock because her manager said, if you play Woodstock, you're not going to get back in time to do the Dick Cavett show. So I really don't want you playing Woodstock. And she sat there in that hotel suite with a grand piano, and she wrote that song. And they came back from Woodstock, and she said, hey, I want to play this tune. And it, when she wrote it, it was half finished. And it was a sort of a minor key, haunting song. And it's a great story. I don't want to tell the whole story.
Read the book, yeah.
Exactly.
You also talked with maybe the least likely performers to be there, the members of Sha Na Na.
Yeah, who'd have thunk that they play Woodstock? They stuck out like a sore thumb. they were a glee club at Columbia University. But Michael Lang, you know, he wanted, like, for instance, Jimi Hendrix was not his first choice to close the festival. You'd never guess in a million years who his first choice was. It was the singing cowboy, Roy Rogers. He wanted Roy Rogers to sing Happy Trails to You as the last artist. And when he called the great cowboy, Roy Rogers laughed in his face.
I love that story. We're talking with Mike Greenblatt. His book is called Back to Yasgur's Farm. I read an interview recently with a Vietnam vet who had just come back from Vietnam, made his way to Woodstock, and looked around and still had the short hair and wasn't sure he would fit in. And for him, as I'm sure it was for a lot of people, it was Country Joe and the Fish who made him realize, these are my people.
Exactly. As far as I'm concerned, Country Joe was the heart and soul of Woodstock, because when he came out, he was forced on stage He was only ready to play with his band on Sunday, but he had to be forced on stage because the interminable wait in between acts was ridiculous. So they said, someone's got to do something on stage, and he went out and he started playing. He played that song he wrote for a former girlfriend, Janis Joplin, and then he played some country songs. He was totally ignored. The people were at like a family picnic. He walked off stage. Nobody even noticed. And he came back and he did the fish cheer. Well, I can't begin to tell you. When he said, give me an F, gave it to him. Give me a U. I'm not going to spell it on radio, but you know what the word is. The point is that to shout that word out with tens of thousands of people around you at the top of your lungs when you're 18 was exhilarating. It was liberating. It was hilarious. And that right there represented pure freedom.
So, Mike, 50 years later, what's the legacy of Woodstock?
That, it was like Max Yazger said, that all those people, 500,000 of them, could come together for 3 days of peace and music and have nothing but peace and music. I still get teary-eyed when I hear him. Of course, he didn't include the fact that we were all smoking pot. But you know what? That's besides the point. Maybe the world leaders today should smoke some pot and there'd be more peace. Because how can you have all those negatives and still everybody helped each other? Everybody was friendly. The vibe at Woodstock, I cannot begin to... I know it sounds corny at this point and cliche, but we're flashing the peace sign to everybody. You know, it was like these were our brothers. We went, like Paul Simon wrote in America, looking for America. And we found them. We found like-minded long hairs that were all against the war, all for women's liberation and civil rights. And we all agreed on everything at Woodstock. It was amazing. And politics was a subtext.
And, Micah, you're going to be there for the Woodstock weekend. You'll be doing a book signing right under a tent. Our friends from American Nomads will be there as well, doing a set on Friday, 5 o'clock, the non-pavilion stage at Bethel Woods. So the book, look forward to more success with the book and people taking a trip back to the past to that incredibly memorable moment. Good luck this weekend as well, and thanks for spending some time with us this afternoon.
Well, thanks for having me. I loved it. That was so much fun.
That's Mike Greenblatt, the book, Back to Yazger's Farm. Woodstock 50th anniversary, and we mentioned American Nomads. They were on with us a while back. They've written a new song, Looking Back at Woodstock. It's called 1969, and let's play some of that as we head on into the break. It's Downtown on Z62 Retro Radio.